Hey folks, welcome back to The Ferment. My name is Marcus Peter Rempel. It's good to be with you. Today I'm excited to share an episode that is the fourth and final in a series of conversations with folks who have studied the work of Illich and have taken it further in their own writings and work. Very happy today to have two women, Catherine Buble and Michelle Berry Lane, speaking into this series of Illich conversations. Catherine Buble is Assistant Professor of English at Trinity Western University, and Michelle Berry Lane is a poet, a teacher of environmental science, and a student of theopoetics, and also a part of Rochester Pollinators, a pollinator advocacy organization in Southeast Michigan. They've both been participating in and listening in on the previous three conversations, and it felt like it was time to hear some more women voices, and I'm really grateful to David Benjamin Blower for both discerning that need and finding a way to invite these two women to really round out our conversation. I've entitled this episode Ave Maria Sophia Gaia. Besides my love for alliteration, this brings together really different ways of naming the sacred feminine in the Christian tradition, but also well beyond it. Sophia is the Greek name for wisdom, also the name of my youngest daughter. Maria, of course, refers to Mary, the mother of Jesus. And Gaia is a Greek goddess who later gets turned into Pandora, really the goddess of the earth, who is a livelier presence with more to say than Pandora, She's kind of transmogrified into later on. I found this really helpful to learn more about from Catherine. She makes references to some writings and a video that probably would be helpful for you to. You might even want to take a look at these or read these before getting further into the episode today. One reference she makes is to an interview between Illich and a friend called A Certain Regard, where he talks about Pandora and the myth of Prometheus and Epimetheus. You've been hearing in these conversations references to Prometheus and Promethean ways of being in the world, and we haven't really unpacked that all that much here, so it's probably worth doing a bit of checking into. A thumbnail sketch from what I'm learning is that Prometheus is really the archetype of the human being who experiences the earth as a source of troubles and also as a source of resources. He's the one who steals fire from the gods and really through technology starts conquering the various troubles that the earth sends his way and becomes more and more successful in pulling more and more resources out of an increasingly tamed and domesticated earth. Epimetheus is literally means hindsight or looking back, whereas Prometheus means looking forward or foresight. So Epimetheus is the human being who experiences earth as voiced and has a relationship with the earth of listening and responding. He's the one who stays with Gaia and listens for the dream of the earth, as Illich explains in the video A Certain Regard. I think this is the kind of human being that I find among many more of my indigenous friends. And I think there's there's a lot to unpack there. It's a symbol that offers a lot to us in our particular moment and our present crisis. And then Michelle, as a scientist and a daughter of scientists, brought some lovely insights about conviviality and contingency, both very important categories for Illich. Conviviality of and with the bees, with pollinators, and also inside our bodies, and that connects to a sense of contingency that she really brings forward, a sense that a way that moderns can understand contingency is the way we're coming to understand the absolute dependence that our lives have on the health of our relationships, both the flora and fauna inside our bodies and the flora and fauna of the living earth that we are members of. That resonates a lot with me as a marriage and family therapist. Also could add to that, there's a ton of research really to show how much our health depends on our human-to-human relationships, whether that be between lovers or parents and children or friends. I should add that towards the end, there's David Cayley jumps into the mix and has some exchange on questions about science and the overreach of science, as well as the appropriate place of the sciences in discerning the way forward as human beings that want to live together in a good way and discern the limits of what constitutes a good life. So yeah, I'm really happy to share this conversation. It's been a fun ride for me to be part of hosting these conversations, and I'll in upcoming episodes I'll focus more again on getting chapters of my book uploaded, and then who knows, we'll see what other adventures seem appropriate to the platform of the Ferment. Again, if you're enjoying what's happening here, you can go to Patreon. There's a link at our website to support the podcast. I also want to acknowledge the ambient music that I've been using in these series comes from David Benjamin Blower. If you want to check him out and hear this same music with higher production value, I encourage you to check him out on the Messianic Folklore podcast that he hosts. Yeah, just really glad to have you partaking in these conversations here at The Ferment. Blessings, peace, and all good, and enjoy this conversation.
Welcome all to the fourth and final Illich conversation in this series, at least. For this gathering, we have a conversation to begin with between my friend Michelle Berry Lane, who's a writer and a poet and a teacher of science and environmental studies, a student of theopoetics, and an advocate of bees. I think that you, Michelle, work for an organization that is looking to preserve pollinators, if I haven't got that wrong. Michelle is talking to Catherine Booble, who's assistant professor of English at Trinity Western University. And Catherine was part of the reading group that was originally meeting around David Cayley's recent book on Ivan Illich. So, Catherine, can I hand it over to you to start, and you guys can begin your reflections.
Sure. And I'll say I'm very grateful for this opportunity to hang with you all in this strange room. We wish that we were around a table with a candle burning, but we can't imagine that. I'm sorry that I have not been here for all of the conversations, but I was here in the beginning. And so I'll start by saying, in the end is the beginning. I really appreciated Marcus Rempel's and Douglas Hines' tribute to David, and I would like to join with that in expressing gratitude to and for David Keeley. I've been learning from him for years without him knowing it, like Marcus, through the CBC radio documentary series Ideas. And I had come across his blog, I can't remember how, but somehow early in the COVID pandemic, I was trying to make sense of what was happening. And I can't remember whether someone directed me to a blog post of David's or whether I was looking for something else on his blog and found a remarkable posting there, an open letter to critics of Agamben and invoking Illich. And it helped articulate things that I was wrestling with. And I was telling my spouse last night, I feel like David has been like a Gandalf to me through the little journey that we've been on through the pandemic years and the apocalypse of those years. But I had long been following him, learned about Rene Girard through him, and in I think it was probably through Charles Taylor's book A Secular Age that I learned about Illich and was intrigued by Illich. So I was delighted in a happenstance. I won't try to explain how it happened. It was a surprise, pure contingency, that I was invited to join a book club in 2021 that Marcus was part of the hosting of, that around Ivan Illich, An Intellectual Journey, David Keeley's book. And I'm just so grateful how he has generously shared the fruits of his friendship with Illich and of his own wide-ranging thought that remains hospitable and open to surprise and to the stranger, the unexpected one who shows up at his door, even if it's a Zoom door or a Zoom room. So I'll say that my knowledge of Illich comes through that book club and reading that book, and that I am familiar with and have been for some time with his word that circulates for some reason here and there, it comes up, his use of the word conviviality. And I'm in love with that word. I love that what he means by it is, I'm quoting here, autonomous and creative intercourse among persons. And so I truly believe that that's what this group is participating in. And then also the intercourse of persons with their environment. And I have been for years seeking to better understand and better live conviviality with my place. And the fact that this is contrasted, his idea of conviviality is contrasted with the conditioned response of persons to the demands made upon them by others and by a man-made environment. And so conviviality to me carries enormous environmental import. And I will say that that's what I went into the book club in 2021 with that on my mind. And so I proposed to David Blower that a couple of things that intrigue me, and I'd like to talk with everyone about it. And I think I saw David joining, so I sure hope he will join in too. Are these two, there were two points that were particularly intriguing to me in Illich's thought. And one of them was this anomalous myth that he identifies with, the Pandora myth, an Epimethean man, and his reference to the Hesiod telling of the Epimetheus Pandora story, which I hope we're all familiar with. I won't try to recount that story, but I can say that you could go find it online. He was in conversation with Eric Frum of the Frankfurt School, and the article is The Dawn of Epimethean Man. It was an address that he gave, I think, to Eric from somehow, And so you could find it online and read for yourself how he works his way through it. But I had found it also on a video where he tells, he's in conversation with his friend, you remember his name, Jean-Marie Domenech. And the video is called A Certain Regard. And even the title of that, A Certain Regard, I think beautifully captures what Illich saw in this myth. It's an intriguing way of reading it from the side of Epimetheus as the person he identifies with versus Prometheus. And I think we all know the story of Prometheus being the great sort of savior of Aeschylus's Prometheus Unbound, or Bound, Unbound comes later. He who brings fire to humanity, the creatures that he had formed out of the clay and had Athena breathe life into them. And this creation, creator savior character, Prometheus, is usually the hero. He is the hero of many of the romantics. This idea of the Promethean spirit in humanity being that which is always striving for flourishing. And he's the one who brought all kinds of techne to humanity, fire being the major symbol of that, the fire of the gods. And so it was so striking to read in the middle of the book, Kaylee's book, the central chapter is on gender and Illich's book on gender, which I guess was a fateful book, was not understood at the time. But the way that David explains it, it's a book about complementarity and otherness. And so this combination of, in the middle of this book, the polarity, and not in an antagonistic way, but a polarity that is complementary, complementarity, that was what was at the heart of gender. And that in the middle of this chapter, or in the midst of this chapter, and then near the end of the chapter, there's reference to this myth that that Illich was so intrigued with, and why he identified with Epimetheus. So I feel that there is environmental significance. My mind converges in a number of ways around how Illich reads this myth, but one of the main things that strikes me is what he says, that he wants to be the Epimethean man rather than the Promethean man, that he sees Pandora as a diminished patriarchal version of the earth goddess, or Gaia. And that at the time that he was writing and thinking about this, he was in conversation with Eric Fromm. He'd also been in conversation with, and I don't know if I say Gershom Scholem, his name properly, but a scholar of the Kabbalah. And as I was reading this chapter, I was hearkening back to what I wrote my master's thesis on, which was the Sophia figure in the scriptures, the wisdom, divine wisdom figure. Some call her the feminine face of God, where in Proverbs, she is calling the little ones, anybody who is humble enough to turn to her and listen, she calls them to her feast and lays out life for them. And she identifies herself as the one who was the first created by God. Before anything else was created, she was. And for me, that again carried eco spiritual significance as I was learning about this figure and how she had eventually impacted two poets that I was interested in, Gerard Manley Hopkins and Thomas Merton, who, like Ivan Illich, were devoted to the Virgin Mary. And so I found in my MA research this combination of a creational, the voice of creation in Sophia, and Mary, the first to say yes to God and welcome God in the flesh into the world. I think it was Hans Urs von Balthasar who wrote that Mary's yes and Christ's yes are combined in the moment where she receives the Holy Spirit, comes over her, and she conceives and bears the Christ, the Theotokos. So again, when I'm reading Illich's figure of the Epimethean man standing on the side of the earth goddess who's been diminished by patriarchal telling of her story into Pandora, who is a controlled and contrived figure, I also thought of what Pierre Hadot in The Veil of Isis identified as two stances of the human, one of them being the Promethean, which is the technological grasping and controlling, or the Orphic, the Orpheus story being of singing and listening to the earth. And so I felt that Illich was capturing something of the Hebraic and Christian Sophia figure, and his Mariology is, in David's telling, quite entangled with the way that he understands Pandora. And for me, why do we attend to this strange image of Pandora? And there's a video in which he as I said, is being interviewed by his friend, and it's the threshold of what he wants to say about Epimethean man as the one who does not control, but who listens and stays to the dream of the earth. And that he even says, if we don't turn back to her, and he says, she lived, and I believe she still lives in her cave at Delphos, listening and attending to her, if we don't regain our ability to recognize dream language that she alone can interpret, we are condemned, he says. The world cannot survive. And so there's something about even the very call to attend to, for me, the wisdom figure in the scriptures, which I came across. I'll say one more thing, and then I invite Michelle to join me in thinking about this, but just, I've been also reading and pondering Dietrich Bonhoeffer's exegesis of Genesis 1:1-3, the passages on the creation story. And he has this enigmatic, you never hear Bonhoeffer use the word myth, but there is this moment where he is unpacking the passage, and God separated the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening and the morning, and that was one day. And that was the first of his creation. And so for me, I give her the voice of Sophia, like this creation, the day, to me, that is Proverbs wisdom, divine wisdom, being the voice of the earth, saying, I was with him in the beginning before anything else, before the foundations were laid. Well, we see in Genesis, the day is the first of all creatures. And Bonhoeffer says, the day possesses its own being, its own form, its own power. It's not the rotation of the earth around the sun, which can be understood physically, or the calculable change of light and darkness. The day is something exceeding all this, something determining the essence of our world and of our existence. If it were not such an unsuitable thing to say in this context, he's in a seminary, we might even say that it is what is called a mythological quantity. The gods of the day and night who, according to pagan belief, inspire and animate the world, are here totally dethroned. Nevertheless, the world remains God's first creature, both wondrous and powerful in the hand of God. For us, he goes on to say, the creatureliness and miraculousness of the day, who I have come to think of as Sophia, has completely disappeared. We have deprived the day of its power. We no longer allow ourselves to be determined by the day. We count and compute it. We do not allow the day to give to us. Thus, we do not live it. Today, less than ever, for technology is a campaign against the day. The day, which is the great rhythm, the natural dialectic of creation, the polarity of light and darkness, the coming and the going. And so what I hear Illich talking about is being on the side of those who will allow the comings and the goings, those things like dreams that come out of the depths of our being, our unconsciousness, where our mind or our knowing meets our body, are where the dreams come from. And so to be with Epimetheus is to try to listen to the rhythm of the earth and the dream of the earth, and to not fix the great rhythm, but to seek maybe with our tools to be aligned with that great rhythm. So I'll stop. There's so much more I've been thinking about, convergent thoughts around this figure, but I propose that Pandora, Gaia, and Chokhmah in the scriptural account of creation, and then in Proverbs, have something resonant between them that I, in my pursuit of eco-spiritual stance to the earth, have found to be a symbol worth contemplating.
Wow, I just hung on every word you were sharing with us. Catherine, thank you. And I can't claim to have done all of the study and reading that you've done surrounding the topic that you've brought to us today. But what I can tell you is something that really stuck with me was this braiding together of wisdom and the earth. And how that to me is like an embodiment of wisdom, that there's so much that we can learn about wisdom by observing the life around us everywhere. I mean, this planet is saturated with life. And also relational processes, you know. And so I'm really taking that in, that idea of wisdom, Sophia, and the earth being one. And I love your pointing out, and I this is something I have thought about, is Sophia being there before everything. Being there even, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, there's even something where she says she was there before God, even almost as if God arose from wisdom. And I may be wrong. Correct me if anybody knows, please. I'm just, you know, riffing off the top of my head, but that was something that I feel like I've grabbed onto at some point in time in the past. So I'm just going to throw that out there.
There is a tradition that sees there's a divine creation, a divine wisdom, and a created wisdom. And so Thomas Merton, in his encounter with the Russian sociologist, saw that she could be a reference to the relation. In the divine sense, it's the relation or the ousia of God. And in the created sense, she is the first creature of God. So there's a complementarity. I think, David, you've talked about Illich and correspondence. And so I think it's as above, so below in the creation myth for the Judeo-Christian tradition anyway. So in some sense, both and.
Mm-hmm. And actually looking at how the space between the creator and the created is quite small. That's what I hear in what you just said. And the idea of relationship as in some ways a revelation of the divine. So when we think about the ecosphere of the earth and all of creation, all of everything that is so deeply interconnected, I've been just sitting with this idea lately that actually it's that interstitial space between bodies where relationship forms, and that that's kind of like a divine space for us. That's a way that we can perceive a whole if we're tuning into, you know, if we're moving in that direction, you know, if we're open to those possibilities and we're not so fixed on hierarchies and control through our technology, you know, when we're not so transfixed with our own power possibilities, I guess would be a way to say that, you know, if we're so bought into the supremacy of humanity and the objectification of pretty much everything else, you know, that comes out of modernity, then we lose sight of that relational beingness that really is kind of a holy mystery in a way.
Yeah, and that was from what I understood of David Cayley's chapter on the book Gender and Complementarity. That was what Illich was trying to convey in that book, was around relationship. That God meets us in the other. And so if we erase otherness, which modernity does, and which technology, for all of the talk of diversity, is, I referred to Eric Fromm from the Frankfurt School, and something that I've read recently by Horkheimer and Adorno from the Frankfurt School is around the culture industry and how it is homogenizing and erasing imagination and indifference, for all of the talk of difference is not really difference. And so I think that's my understanding of what Gender Illich was seeking to recall. He doesn't try to recover what is gone, but what can we bring forward? I think that's part of what he means by Epimethean man, is listening to the dead and what they have to give to us. And so part of the hearing the dream of the earth is hearkening back to how it once was and listening to the stories, looking at recovering the ways of life that have been erased by homogenizing modernity, and thinking how can we go forward, not back to where we can never return, but forward with what those stories, those memories, those traditions, how can they open up a pathway forward? And so that let otherness of the dead speak to us as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something else that I heard Catherine saying is balance. In several things that she was talking about, she's talking about the balance of things, which again has a lot to do with relationship. And when we fall out of balance, when we fall out of relationships that are basically essential, things begin to unravel, you know, because there is the necessity for a myriad interconnectivity, you know, in order to exist. Nothing can exist on its own, essentially, in this world. Every breath we take is not ours. We did not make it. And then that, so that was one of the ideas that I kind of threw out for a possibility was Illich's idea of contingency, or he writes about it in the Rivers North book. And I was thinking, you know, about how that notion of contingency has changed through the ages, and how, you know, if we go back in more ancient times, all of creation was contingent upon God's will and grace at every moment, essentially. That was the contingency for existence, was God's continuous grace and will bringing everything into being, essentially. And through the project of modernity, slowly over time, I mean, this didn't happen overnight, but as humans began to explore more, accumulate more, desire to accumulate more, and the colonial project began, all of that coincides with the beginning of modernity. We think about like Descartes and Francis Bacon. And it's only in the utter separating of ourselves from the contingency of God that enables us to do things like vivisection, for example. The notion that, you know, nothing but a human has a soul. Nature is no longer permeated with aliveness, right? And if it's no longer permeated with aliveness in its own right, then we can pretty much do whatever we want to with it. And that serves our projects, that serves our ability to capitalize and develop, extract, even sort people into different categories of worth. So people who are unlike those who are at the helm of the modernity project, essentially. So, yeah, but even in all that, here we are in the 21st century, and we are, you know, I was saying at the beginning, before we began, I'm watching the first snow today outside of my window, and I find that we are getting so much less snow than we used to, that I find myself just lingering on it now in the winter, because I love snow. I love the winter. I loved Michigan winters. That's where I'm from, for those of you who joined us after we said that. And I feel such a sense of sadness at the diminishment of winter in my life. And so that's my personal response. But the fact is, we're in this place of climate weirding because of human, you know, industry, essentially, and the capitalist project of continuous extraction, which is also a part of this, these ideas that maybe there's something we can do to fix it. We can sequester carbon. We can shoot it down into the bedrock, you know, and it'll hold there. And that'll help us continue to burn things if we want to, because it won't be as damaging, you know. Like, this is a kind of human hubris that is endangering, you know, all of life, all of survival, all of thriving. So the contingency that we can identify in the 21st century is relationship. That everything, every life, every bit of life on this planet is completely contingent upon the health of relationship. And that, of course, brings us to a very Illichian kind of idea of conviviality. It is only through our interrelating that we are alive. And we just happen to have put the blinders on about it as a species in general. That doesn't mean everybody. The dominant members of the species right now on this planet have conveniently forgotten how utterly dependent we are upon others. And that is a heavy truth that we need to sit with and grow through, I think.
I think I can add a little something to what you were saying, Michelle, about relationship and how its conviviality is related to how we take up the earth and the difference between the Promethean. I mean, I operate in symbols before I can get into fine-grained analysis. I must have the dream language of the symbol guiding me. And so it's not, I'm not meaning to, and I believe Illich was not meaning to break off Prometheus from Epimetheus, but in our time, Prometheus is the one, is the God, the savior God that governs all our thought. And it's hard to listen to dreams again. And so one of my questions is, how do we begin to hear the dream of the earth again? And I've found poets are helpful, that especially the ones that know both science and have facility with poesis of language. And so I'm grateful for the storyteller movement that's happening out there. What Paul Kingsnorth is doing, what those in his friendship group, including people who are thinking about, he wrote about in, I think it was The Rain Dance. Marcus, you've referred to The Rain Dance before. It was a blog, there was a blog post by Kingsnorth called The Rain Dance, in which he refers to John Moriarty and his book Dreamtime, in which he's recovering something that I think he got into contact over here when he was in Canada. He lived in friendship with First Nations people and found, as an, I think, Irishman, had more in common with people here from First Nations in terms of storytelling and listening to the dream of the earth and the stories and interpreting them. So I believe that book, the way Kingsnorth lays it out, is a book about recovering indigeneity or, I think he refers to it as indigeneity carefully, but that we all have roots in a people who were once Epimethean, that listened to the dreams of the earth, and how can we in the West recover. I think it's why so many people want to align and appropriate with Native American spirituality in Canada, is that we want to know how to listen again and be in relationship, as you put it, Michelle, and we're at a loss. And so what I take from the gift of John Moriarty and my First Nations friends here is not a come appropriate our ways, but go into your own roots. If the myth of Epimetheus will help you be a better listener, listen to what that myth, that dream of a myth, has to tell you. And we will find we can go forward in a better way. So, I am grateful for the storytelling movement that seems to be capturing imaginations. And thank you to all of you who are part of that.
We have a question in the chat from Lydia Cowell asking what conviviality looks like for Michelle and Catherine. I wonder if you both reflect on that.
Lydia's specific to your worlds of academia and bees, if that helps you get a little more granular.
Yeah, Michelle, talk about your bees.
Yeah, so I work for an organization that advocates for native ecological restoration in our area in order to support invertebrate life, basically. And so the bees and, pollinators, bees are most, prolific pollinators of all. So conviviality in that situation, I mean, people think about honeybees, people think about the community of honeybees and how they make a very, large society of bees that are all working for the common good. It's not necessarily conviviality, but there's conviviality perhaps in the relationship and how some bees are suited for some types of work. Some bees are willing to sacrifice themselves for the sake of the hive. But not all bees, like our native pollinators, and I'm sure it's the same, across the Atlantic with native bees, that they don't all live in hives. Most bees are solitary, essentially. But they're engaging in the process of pollination, which is a very convivial kind of activity because it promotes growth and flourishing among a variety of different members of the ecosystem that are essential to the health and well-being that goes even farther than that instance of pollination. It continues out from that particular ecosystem, connecting to others. I think pollination is a really great example of convivial beingness among a natural, natural setting. I hesitate to use the word natural because I think we use the word natural a lot in a way that separates ourselves from nature. But in the situation, like in our town where we're advocating for planting natives, I guess we're inviting the humans to enter the conviviality of pollination. We're inviting humans to recognize that we have a role to play in the health and well-being of the whole. And without us, if we just continue to plant our European transplants and, have our lawns and spray them and, cut them and throw our leaves in the trash, et cetera, we are decidedly not participating in a convivial kind of condition with the rest of life in our immediate surroundings, even.
There might be an Epimethean way of keeping your yard.
Yes.
So that the dream of the earth.
Yeah, listening to what the earth needs. And also opening the imagination to something other than what we've been handed culturally, as colonials, like we are the descendants of colonial ancestors. So we've been handed ideas about the way to be recognized as a good citizen or a good neighbor in the sense that our lawn looks well manicured and it keeps the property values up, I think,
yeah,
as opposed to actually entering into a living relationship. What's really important. So
your mention of the colonial mindset reminds me, I just recently reread an essay by George Grant, who's a Canadian philosopher who wrote on, in defense of North America, he wrote on the posture or the stance with which we Anglo-Euro settlers came to the land, and how it was the timing of it. I think it was Illich recently I read even refers to 1620. It might not have been him, but the idea of what was going on in Europe at that time with the change of science and the way that we take up the world, that came with us. And I guess maybe like that Promethean spirit came with us and it helped people survive. Although if you watch Terrence Malick's A New World, you'll see that it also made it harder for them to survive at the same time because they could not easily receive from the Native Americans that they met, that did account for how they survived those first winters. I'm thinking about, again, not wanting to separate our tool use, our technology. We are in the enframing, we're in the age of system. How can we be here and still be hearing the dream of the earth? How can we be something other than either or, but both and, is something that's troubling me, because my reaction, maybe being of the European descent, is deeply either or, and I push myself. This is one of the gifts of Illich and David Cayley's writing about him and sharing with us about him, is an invitation to think about staying within contradictions, think about staying within. So even having a little piece of property that we get to tend, that's a modern construct. But how can both be with me, the dream listener and the one who stewards, the one who knows the names of things? And speaking of names of things, you're speaking of the bees and their conviviality, or the symbolism of the conviviality. I'll share this. I'm in the Department of English and Creative Writing. And so when you spoke of bees, I was reminded of this quote by Rilke, which is in the chat now. We are continually overflowing toward those who preceded us, toward our origin, and toward those who seemingly come after us. The idea of continually overflowing is volitional. It is our task to imprint this temporary perishable earth into ourselves so deeply, so painfully and passionately, that its essence can rise again invisibly inside of us. We are the bees of the invisible. We wildly collect the honey of the visible to store it in the great golden hive of the invisible. Now, if I'm right, Michelle, bees don't collect honey. They collect pollen, is that right?
Yes, they don't.
Yes. So indeed, they're much more convivial.
We don't have native honeybees in North America.
Oh, that's right.
They are not native. Yeah. They're actually agricultural.
Introduction. Yeah. Is that the mason? The mason bee is native?
Mason bees are native, yes.
Yeah.
There's like 465 species of native bees just in Michigan.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
A lot of native bees.
And they all have names. And I have to think, well, Michelle, I know that part of the sort of Promethean who is in contact with Epimethea, Epimethean man, is the people who care for bees and intervene for bees. I mean, the very fact that we're having to intervene because of what we've done. And the whole thing, I mean, even that Rilke thought that bees collected honey instead of pollen shows how alienated we can become from these things. So again, attentive science, there's a kind of attentive or contemplative science that I would love to learn more about. I think David, I don't know, David, if you ever interviewed Stephen Talbot.
No.
He's one of those Rupert Sheldrake like scientists though.
Yeah.
I think that will, that I would love to somehow go forward with friends that are scientists of that ilk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm noticing Elias Krim has a hand up.
Hi, and thanks to the host for these wonderful conversations. I'm here courtesy of my good friend Sam Ewell, with whom I've been thinking about relationship and conviviality for a while. So I just had a quick observation. I'd be curious to know if it resonates with anyone. I think this word conviviality, if you look away from Illich for the definition in a way, it sounds rather nice, doesn't it? It sounds like it always makes me think of a garden party or something. But there's something else that I'm noticing that I think is related, which is not about garden parties exactly, and that is we are practicing, it feels like, a kind of conviviality through what's now called mutual aid. I've been thinking about this since COVID. And now we have this kind of accelerating series of climate catastrophes, each one a $1 billion event and so on. So, in a much more necessitous way, there are opportunities now for a kind of reality and a kind of recovery of practices, a recovery under the emergency of these moments, the things we used to know, which after all is a good thing in the midst of this darkness. And then the other thing, which is also, I think, hopeful, is that new community forms in these moments. Some of you may tell can tell I'm channeling Rebecca Solnit, Paradise Built in Hell, a wonderful book. But I wonder if this situation we're in isn't a way in which perhaps conviviality can be rediscovered and reconstructed in some way.
Yeah. I think your observation about mutual aid is absolutely mm-hmm. on point. This is actually something that becomes more and more necessary as these structures mm-hmm. we've become accustomed to, like elections, for example. I'm speaking from a US standpoint. I probably don't have to say much more about that. But things that we had hope in, things that we thought may have provided conviviality, we're mm-hmm. finding yeah. don't. And it's a very disorienting experience. And so, you know, there's a lot of talk about building resilient local community, you know, among certain people. It's not a mainstream conversation. Buzz, if you want to go to the bees, it's certainly buzzing around in my circles. And, you know, we're putting effort into thinking about how that can happen. And I think about Sam's neighboring on purpose idea is such a gorgeous way to say it. And how, because we don't really have structures in the establishment that provides for guidelines or whatever. This is a very much a homemade kind of situation. And we're reading each other. You know, we're putting things out there as much as we can and sharing. And that's also a very convivial movement toward thriving, is this, you know, doing our best to overturn mythology that we've taken as fact. You know, I think of like Paul on the road to Damascus, you know, the scales falling from his eyes, and how this is a scale falling like time that we're in right now. Things are being revealed to us, those of us. I see, it looks to me like everyone here is a white person with European ancestry, or in Europe or in England. And, you know, we have a lot of reckoning to do in order to be as convivial as we can be in our world. So I think listening a lot, reading a lot, you know, having hard conversations, examining things, this is absolutely necessary as we move forward. And in some ways, I'm starting to think of my responsibility to learn and to move through mythologies that I grew up with, is a kind of mutual aid, if that makes sense. You know, it's a kind of offering.
I'd love to ask a question about science. I'd like to ask you, Michelle, what convivial science looks like to you, or where you see it. What does that look like? What examples do you point to? And I guess on the back of that, I'm also curious about science that is not closed off from, I don't know, intuition or spirituality, or, you know, the things that are harder to nail down. I wonder if you could speak into that.
Mm-hmm. For those of you who don't know, my professional life was being an elementary science teacher. And part of the work that I did was also working with adults in university who were learning to be teachers or working on a master's in teaching. And I taught them environmental and outdoor education. So, and in my work as a teacher, I was very much dedicated to, in fact, I felt like it was my mission to get the kids outside as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And to do whatever I could to facilitate relationship with them and the world, the real world, not their, you know, Game Boys, et cetera, Pokemon cards. So to go back to your question, David, just so people understand that I do have, my mother was a biologist. My stepfather was a chemist. I grew up in a scientific household. So science is taking a bad rap these days and deserves it, mm-hmm. because science has served, you know, has served the colonial project, has served the project of capitalism for decades and decades and longer, hundreds of years, actually. But I like the way you said in an email, hope through convivial science, that there is great hope in the science that opens us to the wonder of what mm-hmm. is around us and in us, like the microbiome. Wow. You know, when you learn about how your daily existence is so dependent upon the health of your existence, is so dependent upon literally more microorganisms in your body than you have actual human cells. That is mind-blowing to me and heart-expanding, because I realize I am filled with creatures living their lives, doing the things they need to do, and I am benefiting from it. This is like a deep symbiotic relationship. And if I don't provide them with the nutrients that are good for them, like a healthy human diet, then my health fails as well. You know, as their health fails, my health fails. And that, talk about conviviality, you know, symbiosis in the natural world, symbiosis in the life of the world is, you know, deeply and intimately connected to survival. So, and I think about scientists like Suzanne Simard, who brought us, you know, the science that helped us understand symbiosis between trees and fungi and other microbes in the soil. So this is a multifaceted web of health and thriving that's happening outside of our ability to see, because it's all underground. And it's a communication network. It's a sharing of resources. And Suzanne Simard, you know, she was kind of ridiculed at first. People didn't really, they were like, this isn't hard science, you know, hard science. I'm obviously paraphrasing here and injecting my opinion, but hard science is all about separating and finding the components, right, and how things work. But her work was showing us relationality. Same thing with Lynn Margulis, who was one of the thinkers behind the Gaia hypothesis. James Lovelock gets most of the credit as an atmospheric chemist, but Lynn Margulis developed a theory of symbiogenesis that said the eukaryotic cell, the cells that make all of plants, animals, protists, fungi, algae, these complex cells with membraned organelles within them, like tiny bodies within the body, that they arose out of a symbiotic connection between bacteria that actually merged and became one. And then that one became the first eukaryotic cell. She was ridiculed about that. And now we know it absolutely is the standard. Like, as time went, people went, actually, you know, she kind of had something there. So again, this is relational science. I find great hope as we begin to recognize these interrelationships. We think the opportunity for engaging in a more flourishing way with the world is there. You know, when we can situate ourselves there, it helps us to be better humans.
Do you get funding? There, that whole thing of the universities being beholden that Illich unpacks, of it being almost impossible to be pursuing the convivial and the contemplative and the this way of being in a university where it's competition for the grants, and the grant money is coming usually entangled with large corporations and their interests. It's disconcerting. I can say that I'm grateful that I did get a small grant with a group of convivial friends. One of us had to be the principal investigator. It's almost like we tossed a coin to find out who would be, but it turned out to be me. But I'm in the middle of a little grant-funded project that we're calling Conversing Conserving. And we're in the English department. What can we contribute to the well-being of the place that our learning takes, we call it, this is where our learning takes place. And it's there's a land that has been protected around, that belonged to the university, but it gets neglected or it gets used in various ways. The back 40 has been famous for, I think it has some hidden stories back there. Over the years, the students have discovered the back 40, and apparently there was pot being grown back there even at one point. We're coming alongside our environmental studies faculty who seek to steward that land to say we can contribute. We know the old, you know, it's become trite to say it almost, but we care for what we love and we love what we know. Or you could put it the other way, we care for what we love and we love and we know what we love. Either way, we're calling it ecopoiesis has its contribution to make. So we're sending out, our participants are going out in around the lake and around the woods over the last several months to, with prompts, but just to pray, just to pay attention, just to take their little iNaturalist app when they see something that excites them and take a picture of it and identify it and then write about it. And then we're seeking to, in a qualitative way, see what patterns arise in their writing. But the project itself is drawing attention to place. And our hope is that this would not be a location that they come, the students are coming to recognize place. Their being is not merely in time, which all the bells and the schedule is all about time. Even most of our studies are time-based. So to recover a sense of place, and that place is not abstract space, but it's remembered and storied place. So being a part of this little project with three others has been delightful, convivial. None of us need to take precedence over the other. All of our decisions are made together. Our events are, we seek to converse and conserve. So that's one way I can be in the realm of academia and be seeking conviviality between people and between our environment.
Sounds like a great project.
It's lovely to be a part of it. I'll say the grant part I hated, because you have to reduce everything. All of the relational, I don't know how Suzanne Simard wound up getting funding eventually, but it's so quantitative and abstract. What you have to reduce what you are doing to something, you don't know who's gonna read it or understand it. And so I think, I'm grateful for folks who are, like David Cayley through his blog, graciously sharing ways of learning that are outside of the university. Even university is rather, sounds rather monolithic. I think that's one way that science and poetry are meeting each other again.
Well, speaking of learning outside the university, you both are, I'm loving the different references that each of you are making from your reading, your connections. And in there, I'm noticing, like, I think getting excited about the possibility of a birth or a rebirth of an Epimethean Christianity. You mentioned John Moriarty, who was, when he was not in Ireland, he was briefly a professor here at the University of Manitoba, actually, and his connections with Indigenous folks. You mentioned Paul Kingsnorth already, who's had this interesting recent conversion. I think of a Martin Shaw encountering the mossy face of Christ, as he says, And even Dougald Hine, he's not having a conversion story, but there's a bit of a coming out of the closet process for him recently. Any other voices, you know, that you are familiar with that you might sort of fit under the tagline of Epimethean Christianity? I'd love for you to throw those out there for me to add to my reading list.
I would say Wendell Berry, absolutely.
Yes, yeah.
And David, and you just...
I'd love to see Wendell Berry and Ivan Illich in the same room together having a conversation.
I think we do.
David,
I think
might
we
know
do
something
get to see
about
that.
Oh, it's really?
I think maybe we do get to see that in the mind of David.
According to Wendell, they once shared a hot tub. Somewhere in Texas, a long, long time ago.
I heard that story
I love Ivan Illich and Wendell Berry in the hot tub. That's great.
David, do you think that was
hope they had a good David, cocktail too.
David, do you think that was related to when he spoke on Mnemosyne and the myth of water in Texas?
Yes, it was probably at the same time. That would be my guess, because that maybe that's why he was in Dallas for that meeting. I don't know.
Maybe that's why he was in a hot tub.
Wendell did tell me that story. So,
wow.
And I was glad of it. And Wendell Berry, I became connected to him when I heard from my publisher that they called and said you might be interested. Wendell Berry had just ordered 12 copies of The Rivers North of the Future to distribute to his friends. So that put us in touch and led to an interview, which I cherish. That was in a series for the CBC called How to Think About Science. Wendell is a keen reader of Illich and even did me the courtesy of reading my book. So I was pretty pleased about that. I would like to say something about science, if I may, but since I have the floor and I may not get it again, Catherine, I want to thank you for what you said about those final pages of the gender chapter. Maybe I speak for all writers who aren't always read as carefully as they might wish to be. And the fact that you understood what I was saying there and even hinting that Ivan, the old patriarchal patriarch who was practically thrown out of Berkeley, was actually a secret goddess worshiper. Mm-hmm. I'm very glad you took note of those pages. And I think the remarks to Dominic in that interview, A Certain Regard, in which he really does say that what is absolutely crucial is to re-enter the dream of the earth, is a quite a remarkable statement and quite a interesting way to enter Ivan, to look at other things Ivan did. Also, it makes me happy whenever anyone understands gender, because that but about science, to bring up in another book, in Tools for Conviviality, Ivan says that there are three conditions for recovery. He was thinking very optimistically at that point, or writing in hope. And one of them is to overcome what he calls the delusion about science. Yeah. He doesn't say a great deal. It's only a couple of pages. Essentially, the delusion about science is to believe that science is some sort of it's a staple. It's an industrially produced and certified staple. There's a much more that could be said, but I myself would wish that the word science would be put on the shelf forever, or once again made to signify knowledge, which is what it signifies. But I have listened now through this dreadful pandemic to so much nonsense about science and following science. And it's just idle. It's just an idol. It's absolutely an idol. It doesn't mean anything at all. There's no such thing as science. There are many science, and I don't believe either that there's any such thing as the scientific method, which is what people will usually fall back on when challenged to answer the question, what is science? I believe there are sciences of many different characters and many different qualities and many different modes of knowing. And so if we were to return to the idea of natural philosophy, which was the name under which Bacon and his friends began the project, I think we'd be much better off and much more able then to also perceive the realm of human judgment, human moral judgment, because one of the claims made for this idol during the pandemic was that it could completely replace judgment. Every politician in Canada ran to hide in the skirts of science when there was no science, when nobody knew anything. There has to be some way of restoring questionability to science and to show it as a mode and not the only mode, although a valuable mode, of philosophical knowledge, resting on certain stances, certain preconditions, certain assumptions, like every other kind of human knowledge. So I'm with Ivan, writing in 1973, right? We're not going to get anywhere until we get over the delusion about science. And I would go so far as to extend that even to the sciences of climate change or anything else on which society is literally going to war over whether this can be settled science and therefore we can excommunicate all the doubters or make them all as dupes of the oil companies or whatever the current discourse is. The climate, I would say an Illichian stance, I hate that word, but is to say that the climate is probably too big and too abstract to model. And that the attempt to model it, I noticed someone in the chat noticed this, and I'm always grateful when somebody notices it. It is part of our hubris to think that it can be modeled. The climate change models have not worked very well. They don't explain the past very well. They can't tell you why the medieval warm period was warmer than it is now. We don't know what's happening, and we don't need to know what's happening. If we have faith, hope, and charity, we don't need to know how many molecules of carbon we're allowed to put in to the atmosphere. And if we live decently, and if we live within moral limits, and if we know how much the message for conviviality, how much technology comes between us, and therefore we responsibly limit technology, we will not need to engage in this discourse. When I invited Ivan Illich to Toronto, now that I'm wound up, me, I can't stop, in 1970 when he addressed a teach-in, and he said that the world, in his view, he was reflecting on the image, the recently seen image of the Earth, photographed from space, the famous image, which now people wear on their t-shirts, and it's a great cause of misunderstanding that we can somehow grasp this thing, right? That the dream of the Earth is not the dream of a planet seen from the outside. It can't, I don't see how it can be. But he said, now that we've seen this thing, two paths are open. One is to repent, in effect. I'll just leave it at that. The other is, enter into an ever more minute environmental regulation. It's to enter into ecocracy, which we're living in amongst all the other crises that we live in, is ecocracy, and this idea that we've got to count every molecule. And so I would, and this is, David, this was stimulated by your asking this question about science. I would say we need to get over the delusion about science and begin to speak of sciences, to give them their due, to stop believing that science will ever generate peace. Bacon's dream, it will never generate peace. It's generating war now. To stop yelling at each other about who's an anti-vaxxer and who's a vaxxer and who's for science and who's against science. It's all how people are disposed to. We can't settle anything on the basis of how we're disposed to this idol, which doesn't exist in the first place. Here endeth the lesson.
I'd like to propose a symbol instead of the blue planet, although it is beautiful. Is maybe that's something that I have recovered from the Hokma Sophia figure, is the tree of life. And then add to it, in our present moment, Suzanne Simard's, there'd be a lot of mushrooms at its roots growing around it. And indeed, one of the participants in my friends and I, the project, we have a poet artist who is out sketching the trees. And the main tree that is present in the more than human community around our campus is the red cedar, which amongst the Stalo people out here is called the tree of life. And so she is playing with her biblical poetic, theopoetic imagination, and with what we learned from an elder who walked with us and talked about the red cedar. And she's been contemplating and praying with the trees. And so I think I've been thinking about what's the symbol. And I don't think we can do better, someone might argue, but I don't think we can do better than recovering the tree of life as the symbol for proper Scientia and Sophia meeting together, or Sapientia meeting together. Someone once recently proposed to me that in the garden, the two trees were actually a Janus-faced one tree. And the tree of life is received, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was that which was grasped before it was given. And so there's something about the possibility of the reconciliation or the bringing together of, is it possible that those two trees, since we've got both of them in our being, mythologically, can they be brought into that contradictory, complementary relationship again of technology, Promethean spirit being turned into something different, and Epimethean man, his way, our way of taking up the world as listening to the dream of the earth. I guess we need to recover and bring forward the great creation myth that we live with, the Onto story, as Jane Bennett calls it. And I'll put a promo in here for one of the poets, or one of the, he's like a poet, one of the scientists that I'm finding to be a thinker of complementarity and of contemplative and active science is Stephen Talbot. So he is in the, I've put him in the chat, but he is always seeking to show how both logical thought that brings us clarity and analysis has to be in relationship with the fullness of experience that we get with myth and with dream. And if they're held in complementarity, a polarity that's complementarity, then we get a different kind of science and we get a different kind of storytelling, because storytelling isn't just good in itself. Like, we're seeing myths all around us, religiosity, in improper stances to the world all around us. So it's not like either one of them on their own is enough.
Yeah, there needs to be open conversation for sure. And with all due respect, David, I would just challenge a little bit what you said. And that is, I think science has gotten us into some pretty difficult conditions right now. Not just science, but capitalism and human supremacy, all of these things, and our unchecked burning of materials, you know, has truly created a chemical change in our atmosphere, which is truly impacting the quality of life and the conditions for life on this planet. And that's real. That's very real. And some science is needed for us to suss that out, to make sense out of it. And so I just think, like anything these days, we need to have nuance, you know, in our approaches to things. It's not all science is bad, or I think you're getting what I'm saying. It's I'm not looking for a scientific solution to the issues that we have caused. And I believe that the role of imagination is huge here. The role of recognizing our creatureliness, that we're not above all creatures, we are one of them. And if we could reintroduce ourselves back into the ecosystem as a thriving member, instead of somebody who's pulling strings and trying to have the advantage over everything else, I think that's absolutely necessary. But I, for one, and it's probably, I grew up in a scientific household, I sense that the deep questions that some scientists are asking are important questions for us to pursue in terms of our understanding. And it's mostly in terms of I would say it's a way of offering some veracity to people who would question it otherwise, if you're getting what I'm saying. If we can't, there's so many different modes of conversation that if we can't offer a multifaceted view of things, I think we're going to lose people that are essential to creating a space of conviviality on the planet.
In case I was carried away a moment ago, can I clarify my position?
Yeah, please, David. We're pretty well at time, but I think if I've listened, some of my best friends
are scientists.
Yeah. Well, and if I've listened well to both you and Michelle, I think there's not a great deal of space between what you've each been articulating. So I'd love for you before we close to have a chance to respond and kind of help us understand how these can be held together, these viewpoints. Yeah.
I don't think a fitting way of life can be measured in parts per million. And it's an interesting question. If we were not changing the atmospheric composition, I mean, the chemical composition of the atmosphere, would everything be all right then? Is this a good way to live? I don't think it is. And if you can't find in yourself in your community, in your tradition, the resources to know where the limits are. You can't get them from sciences. That is not, I think, what sciences are about. So I'm all for sciences in their place. But right now, as we've seen, it's patent, this is the driver, this is the engine, this is the Führer of our society. And politicians all across Canada were able, without challenge, to get away with it, to say, this is what we must do because we're following science. We're destroying, okay, sure, we're destroying your business, but we're following science. You can't go to church? Too bad, we're following science. Whatever, you can't comfort your dying? Too bad, we're following science. If people don't think that's ominous, then I think they're not listening and not attending. So it's nothing against the practice of this or that science and what can be learned from it. It's a question of what we are and whether we're living in a creation or not. Mm-hmm. So that's all I really want to say.
Did you want to give one more response before we close, Michelle?
Sure. Yeah, I would say all of that. I hear what you're saying, and I agree that it's not just about following the science or doing what science says. There's so much more to it. There's so much more to being a good human in community than just following the science. And as you said, it is a tool. It's another tool that we use to kind of suss out and understand things. We seem to need that. We seem to need to have explanations for our curiosities. Maybe I'll just leave it at that. There's so much more to being a good human than listening to what science says. And there's certainly a lot of discernment that needs to take place when we are listening, not only to science, but all the other voices coming at us. A great deal of discernment and conversation needs to happen.
Well, I'm grateful for a good deal of conversation over the last, 8 weeks? This has been, for someone like me, great fun on a Sunday afternoon. I just want to express my delight that I think is shared with other faces on these screens in the generosity of David, Kaylee, mm-hmm. and Samuel and Dugald Hine to get some conversations going, and Michelle Lane and Catherine Buble to bring some beautiful feminine wisdom in a very complimentary way, round some things out before we wrapped up the series. And I want to say, give a special nod to David Benjamin Blower, who had the sense of the what and the how of making that happen. I'm really glad that he had that vision to reach out to the two of you for this final installment. So that's all the thanks for me. David Benjamin, do you have anything else you want to, housekeeping wise, or any final farewells, maybe comments about where to find yourself, other folks that have been connected to this conversation, if people want to keep following the conversation in some way?
I'm sure if you Google us all, you'll find us. Yes, I'm just grateful to have been involved over the last 2 months, and grateful to Michelle and Catherine for holding the space today.
Thank you for inviting us.
I just want to add one word of thanks to David and Marcus, to everyone for participating. And also I just wanted to say to David Cayley, something that I said to him directly, but I think it's appropriate to share here. It was, David reached out to me. I finished my PhD on Illich in 2014. It was sometime after that, but it was David Cayley. David, it was your reaching out to me and your enthusiastic reception of, I don't even know how you got a hold of an online PhD, but it got out there and you read it and you reached out to me. And that's what gave me the confidence and that wind in the sails to turn it into a book. So, I mean, I think this gathering could pretty easily turn into a David Cayley fan club, but it's just appropriate to recognize you as an elder that's, you've helped me and so many of us cross this threshold into Illich's imagination. So I just wanted to say, it doesn't end here, but it's worth each moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.